Procession number 20512, Reel 3.
General Tower, Reel 3. You were just saying what you said to this Eton master.
We said you must be crazy, the Germans. The 8th Army is 700 miles away, and we want to get south as soon as we can. He didn't understand. Anyway, Nigel Thomas and I sat up all night, and next morning, led by a very nice, very strong Australian lieutenant colonel, we pushed down the wire, helped by the Italian soldiers who'd been our guards. And we got out, and Nigel and I went out of the camp about 200 or 300 yards up to a little plantation where we sat to await events. And very few other people came out. And then that evening, we'd persuaded a local village to cook a chicken for us to eat. And just as I was going down to collect the chicken, suddenly I heard a noise, and a German patrol on motorcycles came up the track. So I wasn't spotted. He came in. It was a fascinating sight to see the British officers who had not decided to escape all running out of the camp. And I'm afraid most of them were recaptured and went off to Germany. Anyway, Nigel and I and about 10 other people started to get out of that area, away from the camp, up into the mountains towards Genoa, which was about 20 miles south of us, 20 or 30 miles. And there were 10 of us to start with, but we soon broke down to smaller parties because it was too much for a farm or village for 10 people to come and spend the night with. And we walked on up to the mountains. And it was all the fun because this was September, and the grapes were all ripe, and one used to walk through a vineyard and just pick off a bunch of grapes and eat the grapes to quench one's thirst. Anyway, we got up in the mountains, and there we sat down. It's called Monte Maggiorasca, I think. And we spent about 2 or 3 days there and went down to the villages to collect food and then find somewhere to drink. And then somehow or other we heard that there had been a radio address by General Eisenhower to say that all prisoners who had escaped were to go to the area of Florence, where they would be picked up by the advancing Allied forces. This was in September 43. So, we started off walking in the general direction of Florence. And it was very difficult going because we hadn't quite realized how difficult the mountains were going to be. And it was always up and down, up and down, and in very little short distances traveled horizontally. But then one day, and the great thing was you had a map, and then you met somebody coming the other way, because Italy was full of escaping people of every sort of nation, including Italians from the Russian campaign. You swapped maps, and one day we got a map, a little booklet, which showed, it appeared, that there was a great ridge running down the sort of spine of Italy. And if you got on that, you'd be all right. So we went up onto the ridge in the next couple of days, and we found it was true. There was an old Roman road running along with old Roman milestones, Roman milestones, running along it. And our progress then became very much faster. And we used to spend one night in a farm nearest the top of the mountains we could, get in at dusk just in time for them to put an extra bit of cereal in the pot. And they were terribly kind and good to us, all these mountain folk. But we made a very firm rule, we never spend more than one night, and we go on next morning. And the only two times we broke that rule, the Germans came up, and fortunately we weren't recaptured. But anyway, we went on, and we went on for 6 weeks. And eventually we began to hear the sounds of the fighting just east of Monte Cassino. And one day, one night, we were just above a river, the Sangro, and the Germans were holding it, and we wondered how we were going to get across. And at dusk, we went down. I remember thinking how cold the water was as we waded across. I think we were getting pretty tired by then, because we'd been on our concentrated food by then for some time. And we walked across the river and then up into the Monte della Meta, which was the range on the other side of the valley. We went up through the cloud. And eventually we got out of the cloud, and there was all this range of mountains in the moonlight. It was a beautiful sight. And at the bottom, we found some Italians, and in a camp. And they said, "Can we do anything to help?" And I saw a great raw carcass hanging up. And I said, "Can I have a cut of meat off there?" And they said, "Yes, help yourself." And we cut two great pieces of meat off. And we both ate them raw. And I never believed I could have eaten raw meat like that, but boy, it was wonderful the way the strength came back into one's body by eating that meat. Then we got up on top of the mountain, and then next morning, when we had got along, by this time you could hear the firing. We were within 10 kilometers of the front line, of the fighting line. We met a chamois. And I said to Nigel, "I think this is a bit too high. We must go down a little bit." So we went down. And eventually we finished that evening up in front of the German guns, but behind the front line. And we had been naive enough to think that there wouldn't be any fighting at the tops of the mountains, but of course we were quite wrong. And that night we wanted to get some sleep. We came pretty tired. And we lay down, we pulled branches over us to try and keep a bit warm, very close together, in each other's arms, I think. But all the leaves fell off, so we didn't get warm. So we walked on, and next morning we sort of went sideways behind the front line. And we couldn't see any possibility of getting through. And then at dusk, we suddenly met an old woman and his son. Her son, sorry, I was caught. And she said, "There's a path down there, we'll get you through." So we found this path. It was dark by then, and we were going, but there was a moon. And we went down the path, and there was a gate across the path, a very narrow little path, but no fence each side. We were very tired, so we didn't realize the implication. And we walked round the gate onto the path the other side. And then Nigel was in front, and he put left foot on one S mine and right on another. He used those jumping mines that came up about so high. And one of them hit me in the chest, and I was wounded in the chest, but mercifully, not too badly. I didn't hit anything vital, but it was rather a shock. So we sat for a bit, and then we saw a light, we walked up a little bit. All the difficulty was where to put your feet. We didn't know where the mines were. But we managed to avoid the mines, and we suddenly saw there was a German soldier under a sheepskin rug, asleep under this light in a little farmhouse, and we left him. And then went on, got to the top. I had to have a short rest. Then we went on, and then Nigel says, "Stop, there's a wire across." And being an engineer, he was a Royal Engineer, he wanted to disarm it. I said, "To hell with that, just let's walk over it." So we went on. Then we went down the mountainside. And as we were approaching the river, we suddenly heard, "Halt, wer da?" There we almost walked into a German patrol post. But we stopped, and then we went sideways, and their patrol came back. Then we crossed the river, and we went up the mountain. And at dawn, walked into a company position of the 45th U.S. Oklahoma Division, who were in a terrible state. They'd had their first battle, and they were all lying around. If we'd been a fighting patrol, we could have decimated them. But I only say that because they became extremely good division later on in the war, one of the best American infantry divisions. Anyway, we got there, and the commanding officer, the adjutant, were both asleep, so we didn't disturb them. And we went, they said, go on down the valley behind you, come to an American artillery battalion, which we duly did. I always remember the wonderful hamburgers they gave us to eat. I mean, the first sort of proper decent food, we had, I think I ate about three. And then I was beginning to feel a bit shaky with my wound. And then we went on and got to the divisional headquarters, the 40th Division, when we were interrogated by the commanding officer, the general. And then went on to Caserta, which was the army headquarters. By that time, I was rather out, and Nigel did the interviewing, again, the debriefing. And I was taken to a hospital in Naples, where next day I had this thing dug out of my chest. And I was quite all right. I mean, I took 2 or 3 days to recover, but next door there was a, well, I'm on there, so I went to hospital ship to North Africa. Very frightening, because of the hospital ships illuminated, but Naples Bay was full of ships, and the Luftwaffe came over and bombed heavily. But mercifully, our hospital ship wasn't hit. But the day before, I'd gone up to 7th Armored Division with Colonel John Coombe, the 11th Hussars, who'd been in next hospital bed to me, and met all my old friends from the desert. Anyway, I then went to hospital in North Africa for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then by getting drunk with a friend in Algiers, he got me a ticket in an aeroplane flying back to Britain, where I left in 1937. This was December 43. And we went off. I always remember first sight of Ireland in the dawn as we came up, we landed at Prestwick. How incredibly green it was after all the desert I've been used to for so many years. And then I came down to London, and I met my wife, to whom I'd been engaged for 3.5 years, and we'd never seen each other. And we got married in December 43. It was rather exciting.
Had you recovered from your wound?
Yes, I was getting rather fat, because I'd eaten so much in fatter than I'd ever been in my life before. And we got married in St. Margaret's, Westminster, the only place you could have bells. And I remember the vicar said, why should you get married in St. Margaret's? What right have you to? And my wife said, my grandfather was rector of St. Margaret's, and I think we have every right to do so. And so we were. And it was lovely, because the bell, of course, it was all sandbagged up there. It was incredibly cold. But 200 people came to our wedding. And it was lovely hearing the bells ringing out. They really just started being rung again in London. All the way as she drove up Victoria Street. But she was got very cold.
And then you went back to the army?
Well, I was still in the army. I was put into one of the divisions that was not going to Normandy by my late commanding officer, Brigadier Claude Eastman. And anyway, that was January 44. In April 44, it had been arranged I should go back with him to my old division, 4th Indian Division in Italy. And I was suddenly sent for by Brigadier Wedderburn Maxwell, the BRA of Southern Command, who said, Philip, I've got a new job for you. He said, Brigadier John, I'm going back to Italy, to my 4th Indian Division. He said, oh, no, you're going in the Airborne Division. And I said, but I don't volunteer to parachute. I don't want to. I think they're a noisy lot. He said, oh, you're going in a glider, and you'll be ordered to do that. So I then became Brigade Major, our Royal Artillery, of the 1st Airborne Division. And in due course, we went to Arnhem after 17 cancelled operations. People's morale was getting a bit low. We thought we were going to miss out on the war.
Who were the particular people with whom you were associating in the 1st Airborne Division at the time?
Well, of course, General Roy Urquhart, who commanded it, and Brigadier Lathbury, Brigadier Hackett, who he was then, and Major Tiny Madden. We were a small, our divisional command had a small tactical headquarters that was at Moore Park, which was General Browning's Airborne Corps headquarters. We lived there to plan each operation. And I always remember the Arnhem operation was originally going to be done by just one division, 1st Airborne, and three brigades, and then that was cancelled. Because he was obviously beyond our powers. And then it was suddenly put on again with three divisions instead of three brigades. And we all went back. And during that 3 months from D-Day onwards, we planned, as I say, 17 operations, two of which the Pathfinders had actually left and had to be recalled, because we had a Pathfinder company that dropped marks the drop zones. And the troops were getting pretty frustrated. And then we went to Arnhem and we fought there. And
can you tell me about going across to Arnhem, please? What your memories of going across were?
Well, the first day we took off, and I was towing my horse glider with my signalers and my wireless truck from an airfield called Fairford down in Gloucestershire. And we were all towed by bomber pilots. And we, anyway, our pilot suddenly decided he wanted to turn out of the stream, and we got involved in the stream going the other way. We were still going west, and we had to turn around a point and go east to join up with the other people, and then go off to Holland. And he turned early. Anyway, we got mixed up with the other aircraft. We had to cut our tow rope, landed back at Fairford, from which we'd taken off an hour before, which was very frustrating indeed. Next morning we were going again, and then there was a very heavy fog and mist that morning, so we, instead of taking off at dawn, we didn't take off till about noon. So that was one of the reasons why Arnhem failed, because the second lift came in so late. But anyway, we got in there, and I had my truck, and we drove in, and we got to the Hartestein Hotel, which was the headquarters of 1st Airborne Division. And we were holding the bridge at Arnhem by then. It was only the second day, and everybody thought we were going to go on and hold it. In fact, our mission had been to hold it for 2 days, and we held it, Johnny Frost, for 4 days, 4.5 days. But, of course, the advance never got up to Arnhem. So I returned and stayed in the Hartestein, stayed with my jeep and truck. And then it was quite obvious we weren't going to move on. I wanted to find somewhere to dig myself in, and one of my signals said, "Come and look, Major Sir." And there was a great dugout, three-sided dugout, frightfully deep, that had been constructed for Field Marshal Model, who was the commander of the German troops in that area. So I put my whole little staff, which was only, I only had two young officers and about four signals, all down in this and my radios and everything, and we were really comparatively safe. For all that time, all the time of the battle. But the battle did get very close. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of yards at the most. I mean, and one stayed there, and one was very lucky. But I mean, I put my head out once, and a bullet went straight through my hair. And so it was a very intimate battle. And eventually, we got the order to withdraw, and we went down to the river, and I was leading my lot down. We got the river and there was no sign of anything. And then mercifully, the first of the Canadian little boats came over from the south side of the river, and I spent the night putting soldiers into these little boats and going across, evacuate across the river. And I always remember how warm the water was. And of course we were firing a tremendous artillery program, keep the Germans' heads down, and it was raining, which was very fortunate. But about 4 or 5 in the morning, I looked over to my right as I was standing in the river, and I suddenly saw rosy-fingered dawn coming up, so I thought perhaps it's time for me to go. So, in fact, I went in what turned out to be almost the last boat across the river. Quite a lot of people swam. It was very warm, and it was a bit of a current, but it would have been quite easy to swim.
When you were in that pit at the Hartenstone Hotel,
yeah.
Were your men able to do much work?
Oh, as we did, we functioned completely as a headquarter unit in our great dugout. We had our radio aerial sticking out, and the radios down below, and we were able to function. We were very lucky. In fact, we were the people who picked up the signal from the people coming up. And it was two battery commanders who I knew and who'd been with me in prison. And eventually, we had an extraordinary radio net with two generals on it and about four brigadiers. And that's how we managed to get far to support our troops in the tiny little air. And so we all walked back then to Nijmegen, where there's a camp, and we were fed. Most of us got very few clothes. We'd taken most of our clothes off for getting across the river in case we had to swim, but we were given things. And then my CRA and I, Robert Leder Simmons, we took a truck to go down to Brussels to get an aeroplane back to England. And by that time, the Germans had cut the road between Arnhem and Brussels. And I remember thinking when we got out of our trucks and waiting for it to be cleared again, sitting very close under the lip of the road, we really would be rather bored to be killed on the way back home, having survived the actual battle. Anyway, we did get back, we flew back to England, and we lived happily ever after. And my wife was working in the Admiralty as a cipher clerk, and she'd been getting the reports about Arnhem on the whole time. So she was in a rather poor state of happiness.
Can we jump ahead now to Aden? Because I think you spent a few months in Aden at the end of our time there.
That's right. I was the last general officer commanding. I was suddenly sent for by the military secretary when I was director of public relations in the army, in the Ministry of Defence, in early 67. And was told that I had a lovely new job. I had a new job, GOC Middle East Land Forces. And I thought that was Cyprus. And I said, oh, how lovely, they had a lovely house and nice climbing noise. He said, oh no, Middle East Land Forces has been renamed, that's Aden. So I said, the equivalent of it, how awful. Anyway, I duly went out to Aden in May 67. And I had to go and be interviewed by the Foreign Secretary, who was in George Brown. And I went in, he was extremely unpleasant to start with, but I was being taken round by one of his officials, Anthony Ackland, who now is Provost of Eton, a very distinguished diplomat. George Brown, when he opened the door, said, go away, I don't want you, I just want the general. So I went in, and he said, sit down. I said, sit down. He said, I tell you, General, I strongly disapprove of you going out to Aden. And I said, well, I've just been telling the Chief of the General Staff, I think it's nonsense too, Foreign Secretary. So he was slightly taken aback at that. I think it's perfectly absurd changing the general at this stage when there's a perfectly good chap, John Willoughby, who'd been in the job. So anyway, he did give me an extremely good dissertation on the state of play in the Middle East and Aden. And he said, have you got anything to ask me? And I said, well, for one second, I've got only one thing, and I'm very serious about it, that I'm sure a stage will come when we shall run down most of our forces, and I may suddenly, if circumstances need it, want a reinforcing battalion at once. When I mean at once, I mean within 24 hours. And that's what I ask you. And he said, all right, you shall. This is George Brown. And in fact, in the event I did have to ask for an extra battalion at one stage in our withdrawal, and he did come out within 24 hours. Anyway, I went to Aden, and everything was going on. My predecessor had made admirable plans for the withdrawal. But of course, it was all based on the use of the Suez Canal. But we had a tremendous amount of stuff in Aden, including a complete new huge telephone exchange that's never been unpacked even. And there were guns all over the place, old guns, historic guns, and an enormous amount of very valuable kit. Anyway, that was all planned for going back in through the canal to England. And then and the ships were using the harbour, I mean, ships all the time, perfectly normal, and we had troops in Little Aden. I used to go over there in my boat. And then suddenly, on June the 20th, everything changed. There was the Arab revolt, there was the Arab-Israeli war, which closed the Suez Canal, and one had to take very violent steps to deal with the revolt of the Arab army in Aden. And
What had caused the revolt?
I think the general sort of feeling that we were going, and the fact that there were so many cross currents of people fighting each other in Aden, basically. I mean, there are a very ordinary lot of Arabs in southern Yemen, or Aden Protectorate, we used to call it. And they were always fighting each other. And I think the Arab revolt had been rather caused by Nasser, who had a large number of troops in northern Yemen then. Anyway, it changed the whole situation, and we had to redo all our plans to send everything round the Cape, by the Cape, which was a fairly major change. Instead of going through, I mean, about 6,000 or 7,000 miles as opposed to 1,000 miles, which was a big problem. And things gradually quietened down. There was trouble in the centre of Aden, which had to be, there was a murder of British troops, and that had to be put down. And the Argyll Southern Highlanders did a very good job in Crater. And eventually, and for a period, everything was reasonably quiet, but we were withdrawing the whole time, and one got less and less information of what was going on up country, because our people who'd been out there were gradually withdrawing. And I remember Charlie Douglas Hume, who was then military correspondent of the Times, came out and stayed 2 or 3 weeks with me, and he used to go up country with his press pass, and get information, and come back to my house in Aden, and write his dispatches and have them sent off, then put on his cap as a reserve officer of the Scots Greys, and be debriefed by my military staff. It was very useful. That was before the poor chap got so ill and died. But in the end, it all worked out all right. A great fleet came in from the Far East, and we started a withdrawal, which was a withdrawal by aircraft, first to Kuwait, and then on from Kuwait in different aircraft to England. And it was successfully completed, and I, with my ADC, thought I was going to be the last person off, because I had a helicopter, and I had my headquarters by then in one of the headquarter ships, HMS Fearless. And we got back there. We just saw the last people off. I got in the helicopter, and the commander of one of the marine groups was determined to be the last man off. He got off after me. But then we turned around, went off, started flying about the 7 or 8 miles back to HMS Fairlies. And I looked at the petrol gauge and I found we were absolutely out of fuel. It was about